Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Happy Shabbat to one and all. I'm here with Kirk tonight. JB is taking the evening off. And Kirk, it's a pleasure to be jumping back into one of the most interesting conversations ever. And I think if you were to rank human beings from most important to least important, and the top two or three of all time has to be this fellow, Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that Moses is, to use the Hellenized version of his name, is one of the top two or three most recognized names in human history.
Undoubtedly.
You can't say Jesus because there was no Jesus. There was Yosha. They didn't know his name. But they got, you know, fairly close on Moses with Moshe.
Okay,
and from Noah's point of view, he's the first conduit from through which the Torah was revealed. So it'd be hard to find a more important personage in the whole litany of human history.
True.
And this myth in religion is that, particularly in Christianity, that God just loves everybody. He's welcoming everybody. Oh, everybody is welcome to him. His arms are outstretched. He loves everyone, cares for everyone. Non-judgmental, and yet this is what he said to Moshe, the individual who arguably is more important to Yahweh than anyone who has ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
Then indeed, Yahweh was displeased. He was disappointed. He was exasperated, annoyed, grieved, vexed, deeply concerned and agitated, even angry and incensed with Moshe. We said, exasperated, what about Aaron, your brother, the Lowy? I actually know that indeed he speaks incessantly, making words come alive. God was really upset.
Yeah.
And upset a single most important person to ever speak. And we've talked a lot about this. I think that Moshe was chosen for a number of reasons. The single most important reason that Moshe was chosen, he was not deployed, he was not commissioned, he was not usurped, forced, compelled.
No.
He was invited, and he was invited to this mission for his own free will, based upon several criteria. I think the most important of those criteria is that whether it's God's preference not to have to emphasize what's wrong with humanity in religious and political and military schemes, whether it's just that his preference is to convey the truth, or whether he knows that those who have been involved in such things and have seen the fault in them and have chosen to walk away are far more powerful messengers and witnesses. But for whatever reason, those who have chosen to walk away from politics and religion, who were deeply embedded in them and understand them, once they have walked away, are appealing to God.
Mm-hmm.
Moshe fit that criteria. Very few people who were ingrained in that stuff ever walk away. You know, clearly Abraham did. Made him interesting. Noah did. Made him interesting. The second, I suspect, is it's just because God has a sense of humor and likes to emphasize important points. So when God was trying to pick a person through whom he could show the power of the Torah to reconcile relationships, the power of the Torah to perfect, what he did is he picked a really bad boy, a rascal, a guy that had a harem full of women. There's so many women, I don't think he even knew half their names. He picked a guy that spent way too much time in fighting battles he should not have fought. He picked a guy that, in one time, was even a traitor for a little bit of his life. So he picked a guy with a lot of faults to show that, no, you don't have to be perfect for me to have a relationship with you. All you have to do is be right. You got to care enough about what I have to say to figure it out, understand it, and respond appropriately, and I'll do the rest. My job is not to find a perfect person. My job is to perfect the imperfect. So David became the perfect example to convey that through. And then when God knew that the single greatest crime that man would ever commit is to misrepresent his words and his name through bad translations and replacing his name, Yahweh, with Satan's title, the Lord, who better to convey his name and his word than a man who stuttered?
Yeah.
And that's the only reason we could ever be told that Moshe stuttered.
That's right.
Why he was reluctant. I don't want to do this. I stutter. That's not the only reason he didn't want to do it. He knew that the Egyptians wanted to kill him.
Yeah, that too.
He hated that place. He didn't want to go back.
No.
And I think there's a third reason that Moshe was chosen. And that is he was reluctant. You know, these people that wake up one morning and say, I want to go do God's will. And no, you don't. You don't even know who he is. When he's got something he wants to do, chances are it's not going to make you popular. And so anybody that approaches is going to begin by being reluctant.
Yeah.
Even Abraham was reluctant. So I think those are the three reasons he was chosen. And yet, so here's Yahweh saying, here I am. You know, I happen to be the creator of the universe. You know, you think you stutter, so that got you upset. And yet, aren't I the individual who created the human mouth, the ears, the eyes? You don't think I can work through you? But the very idea that he would take his words and his name and convey it through a man with a speech impediment.
That's pretty ironic.
Not only his power, but it also shows his humility, and more important than anything else, all the people who would say that you know, you'd ought not say Yahweh's name for fear of mispronouncing it. Well, who's the guy that introduced it to us? He didn't have a whole prayer of saying it correctly. So it completely eliminates all those arguments. So that's a lot of the reason that I think this is important. But here, God is telling us that he was disappointed and exasperated with Moshe, deeply concerned. He was agitated. And then he says, what about Aaron? Now, if there ever was a name for a guy as the undercard in this whole thing, that's the name. Okay, listen, I get it. You don't want to do it. And, you know, I'm all about enlightened free will. So what about a guy named Enlightened Free Will? You come to find out that's what Aaron means. Enlightened Free Will. I got it. I've asked you to do it. You don't want to do it. So, you know, it's all about enlightened free will. And with enlightened free will, he can make words come alive. So the whole premise here is just so utterly appealing. And the next thing you might say is that And this is what Moshe said. Said, you know, hey, if you want to get your children of Israel out of Mitzrayim, Egypt, you go ahead and do it. I mean, if you created the earth, you sure as heck can free them.
Yeah.
God didn't bite, did he? Of course he could. But no, he couldn't. This is where we took that detour last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, where I said, no, God actually could not free his children from the Egyptians. Because it would go against his nature. It would go against his purpose. His purpose was to work with and through and alongside of his creation. He created us to enjoy our company.
Yeah.
We're going to spend eternity exploring and learning and experimenting and doing things with the creator of the universe. And so why would he make an exception and do this on his own when the entire purpose is to do things together?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he was capable of doing it independently because it would go against who he is, in conflict with his very nature and his purpose. So no, he was going to do it with Moshe.
Yeah.
And the thought here is even more delicious, because if you think about human endeavor, it is always might makes right, and it is always the majority prevails, right?
Oh yeah, big number.
And so if man wanted to accomplish the liberation of a people from another country, they would gather together the mightiest and largest military they could muster. They would gather together the largest number of people and the most powerful implements, correct?
Greatest weaponry, sure.
That's man's way. Yahweh's way is not man's way. Yahweh's way is, but he was delighted just with Adam.
Yeah.
He was having a ball build a daggone boat with Noah. He and Abraham and Yitzhak had a ball together with the Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
That's not in the numbers.
No, apparently not.
It's one-on-one, individual relationships. When you're with God, you're the most important person in the world.
Wow.
And so what did God say? One guy. And not even much of a guy. He was 80 years old. He was all broken down. He was chasing after sheep in the Arabian desert. I mean, he found one broken, old, down old guy who was a stutterer. And he says, you're my guy. He didn't pick the most articulate. He didn't pick the best fighter, the most courageous, the best warrior, the most articulate. No, he picked a broken down, former religious guy that had given up those things, had fled them, and is now tending sheep. Which, by the way, is probably the single best occupation a person could have if you're going to rescue God's children, because they're like sheep.
Yeah.
So he was perfectly suited.
Yeah.
That's perfectly suited. But, you know, it's the power of insights. I was sharing with a friend not long ago that while it's true to say that God does not make the path to him easy, because if he did, then heaven and his family would be just like life here on earth. You'd have lots of religious and political morons that just go through the paces and say, here's the answers, and they parrot it and they make it life miserable for the rest of us in eternity.
Mm-hmm.
God makes it hard. You've got to want to know. You've got to invest the time. You've got to think about it, study it. You've got to do what Job did and figure out the right answers.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, he doesn't make it very hard. It's all over the place. It's reconfirmed and presented from every possible angle. And if you just do what we have done right here, how many people are going to take the time to say, why did he pick Moses?
Okay.
And if you take the time to say, well, look at the unique characteristics of this individual, and let's think about why Yahweh would choose him over all of the other people on earth. And what you end up with is insights that enable you to understand God's purpose and nature and how we ourselves can engage with Him in a productive way.
Well, you know, even if you said Moshe knew his way around in Egypt because he had lived there, that was a different Pharaoh group than it was when he was there. You know, the whole prophecy behind Joseph's family going there for 400 years is they, at some point there would be a Pharaoh that didn't know who Joseph was. So we've shifted now from even Moses' time to, as far as I can read in the history books, you've got the southern kingdom or the upper kingdom has defeated the lower kingdom, and these are different folks. He may have known some of the people in the palace when he got there, but that wasn't a big criteria for him other than the fact that he knew where it was or that he hated it. You know, so even the old argument that you might hear preachers say, that's not really true either, because that's a different crowd than the one he left. So he's got no good reason for sending him except that whose right hand is leading the parade is Yahweh's. So.
But that brings my attention to another thing. And I bet you that we could think about the uniquenesses of Moshe and come to understand God's nature. We could do this and come up with 100 more insights. But let me give you one more.
Okay.
You know, when back in the day, right after 9/11, and I'm minding my own business, and I'm an agnostic. And I hear this voice that says, I want you to do something for me. And, you know, we have this whole discussion, and not me. And the thing, it was interesting, and I remember this so vividly, is not once did I ask for my own protection. I said, no, I'll do this if I can negotiate with you, but I want my family protected. I want my house protected because, you know, as former terrorists, they kill anybody that does what you want done. So, but I never asked for my own protection, never once.
Yeah.
Moshe knew that going back to Egypt, he was certainly a dead man.
Yeah.
And yet, that part didn't bother him. And so I think you almost have to be to the point where you say, you know, I'll risk my life to do something that's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
My life is worth giving if it benefits others in a very meaningful way. And I think Moshe had that attitude. Because didn't Moshe prove that he had that attitude when he intervened on behalf of the Hebrew slave that was being beaten by the Egyptian taskmaster? And he stopped the taskmaster from killing him?
Yeah, he didn't hesitate to jump in the fight.
The Egyptian slave to death?
Mm-hmm.
That tells you that Moshe's concern for others was greater than his concern for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the whole meaning behind Passover?
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of reasons that this guy was chosen. And there's a lot of reasons his brother was named Enlightened Free Will. Error. Now, this is what is said next. This is the conclusion of Shemot, named Exodus 4:14. And besides, logam, look. Kenna is one of our favorite words. Behold,
mm-hmm.
If you look up and pay attention, you'll notice that presently, right here and now, at this very place and moment, as a concession and as a condition. When you see Henna and Yahweh's voice, now we did 2 chapters on Henna, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's probably 2 pages the way that I write. If somebody called me a girl the way I talked earlier today, because I have a tendency to be verbose on things. But I love words, and Henna is a word that Yahweh loves. And when he uses it, it means, right now, stop what you're doing and pay attention. There's something that's going to be said. Don't let it just wallow over you quickly, you know, like a stream. Dam this thing up a little bit and swim around in it, because there's something I'm going to share with you here that's subtly important if you take your time to think about it. And he said, so, besides, look, Kenna. He is coming forth, Yasa, to meet you and greet you and call you out. What's the word for to greet you and call you out?
Kara.
Kara.
You need to be from Mikra. or
yeah,
part of
my father. It's the name of my new old boat. The name I'm putting on her. Kara. Welcoming mm-hmm. invitation. So pay attention. Right now coming forth. Presenting itself. Being extended and brought forth. Arriving and appearing before your very eyes is a welcoming invitation. Based upon this man's name, enlightened free will. Based upon the other man's name, which means to draw out from human, religious, and political oppression. Well, what is the means that Moshe was going to use through, that Yahweh was going to use through Moshe to draw his people out, to have them come forth from Mitzrayim, Egypt?
Words.
And the Mikra, the Kara.
And the Mikra. Oh, yeah.
Teruah.
Purim.
Sukkah. The seven Moed Mikra. Based on these welcome invitations of Yahweh. That is how it began. It began with Pesach, followed by Matzah, and then Bakurim, and then the Torah was revealed on Shavuot. And so God is saying right now, look at Moshe. Here's the most important thing that I've got to communicate to you. This whole exodus from Egypt, from Mitzrayim, is going to be based on Kara, on a welcoming invitation to call my children out of human, religious, and political oppression, and to me. And it's going to be based on a verb that also means to read and recite, because we're going to give them the words, as you said, to enable them to understand what it is that I'm offering. So think how powerful that is. It's mm-hmm. not just his brother coming by and saying, "Hey, Moshe, how's it hanging, dude?" You know, no. God is saying, pay attention, stop what you're doing right now, Hannah, think about this. Coming forth, being extended and being brought forth, arriving and appearing to serve before your very eyes, to meet you, to greet you, to call you out, to welcome you, to invite you to become better acquainted, the single most important of all Hebrew words.
Yeah.
God's welcoming invitation for us to join him in Passover, unyeasted bread, firstborn children, the promise of seven, trumpeting out the message, reconciliation, and camping out. That's what he's announcing here.
You know, something you just said about, and you said it many times, and we've all agreed to it, but I don't think I ever heard it anywhere before, where you put together the what really took place. I mean, I know they know it was Passover because the blood, they put the blood on the door and they pass over. But so few people, I think, in the whole world, Christians in particular, don't have a clue that there's Passover and Matzah and Bikurim and then Shavuot, and all of it is so tied in so perfectly. And this story of Moshe and the Exodus is just—I don't think I ever heard that anywhere else. Well, why is that so? It's almost like it's a secret, or nobody ever puts that in, ever connects those four. It's exactly what happened.
Pesach is the doorway to life. Their lives were spared on Pesach, but those who are religious and political, their lives were not spared. Those who chose to follow Yahweh's instructions, their lives were spared on Pesach. It's the doorway to life. That's why the blood of life was smeared on the doorposts, the doorway to life. And then they then separated themselves, removed themselves from religious and political corruption on the day the Exodus began, which was unyeasted bread. Yeast is a fungus. The fungus that they were removing from them is the fungus, this infection of religion and politics. They were walking away from the most religious and political place on earth on that second day. And what did that enable them to become? The children of Israel. Children of Israel. And so then what happened on the promise of seven on Shavuot?
Well, then they were given seven. the Torah
revealed.
So you're enlightened and empowered.
Right.
Of course.
It is the story, that whole Exodus story is the story of the Moed Mikra, of the seven invitations to meet with God.
But I mean, just it's like nobody seems to think of that. Maybe I'm wrong.
And
maybe somebody's out there talking about it. I never heard it before. I mean, and I even knew what the Mikros were as far as the name, the festival feast. And
I will go so far as to say that the Teruah and the Ba'im are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of Teruah is to call out a warning and to proclaim the message, the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What did Moshe do in the Ba'im? He synthesized the most important and salient instructions in the first four books of the Torah, made them relevant in the people's lives, and explained them for them, both the things they ought not do and the things they ought to do, the things they ought to understand, the things that they ought to reject. And then, of course, reconciliation. Moshe himself was kept out of the Promised Land because he took it upon himself to strike the rock as opposed to speak to it. The means to God is not about striking things and breaking them and hurting them and harming them, lashing out at them. The means to God, the living waters, the words. And so Moshe was estranged. That's why we need Yom Kippur on the day of reconciliation. So
it's interesting to note too that it fell to Yahusha to lead his children in, which is interesting.
Yes.
So that's
just as the Yahusha 40 Yobel later would do.
Right.
Behold, pay attention and notice presently, right here and now, at this very moment, as a concession and a condition, he is coming forth in light and free will, being extended and brought forth to meet you, to greet you, and to call you out, providing a welcoming invitation. And when he sees you, he will rejoice, taking this to heart in his judgment with regard to his way of thinking. What that says at the end is not a throwaway line. It's not, oh, jovial Aaron, your brother, the guy that's got the way with words that can crack the best jokes and make the girls laugh. No, that's not what he's talking about here. What he's talking about here is that if you answer this invitation to be called out to be welcome, then when you embrace it, when you come to the right perspective, ra'ah on it, you're going to rejoice. You're going to be happy. These invitations are celebrations. They're parties. They're festival feasts. I'm not asking you to sacrifice anything. I don't want you to sacrifice anything. I'm not asking you to give anything to me. I want to give everything to you. The whole purpose of all of these invitations is for us to have a party together. Great food, great wine, great music, great stories. When he embraces all of this, it's going to be a great celebration. This idea that God wants you to be sad or sacrifice or humble or afflict yourself or rubbish. No, the whole purpose is to have fun together.
To be free. Yeah. A great companionship.
Yeah, to be free. Yeah, he's going to, in his own heart, in his own way of thinking, using his best judgment, he's going to rejoice. Why? Because this is the ultimate answer, the single most important answer ever offered humanity. And this is what is next is interesting. Okay, so Yahweh, who just so happens to be the creator of the universe, asked Moshe to do this mission for them. And Moshe said, no, you're fine for the other. Go do it yourself. And Moshe says, all right, well, no, I don't want to do it. God's grieved. And so God says, okay, enlighten free will, your brother. He's got a way with words. And then he explains how all of this is going to transpire to bring this great joy through the power of the invitation to be welcome. And how that's going to bring such a joyous response to all of us. And then God doesn't back down an iota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he said, hey, God, why don't you go do it? Even now, when he says, what about Aaron? God didn't say, I'll take care of it. You're just walking along for the ride. Aaron's going to do it all. No. He didn't say, all right, I'll have the same kind of meeting with Aaron that I just had with you. let me introduce myself to Aaron, and we'll take it from there. No, God wanted Moshe.
You
want to work with Moshe. And so what he sent to Moshe is, you, then, should speak of God to him. And you should place accordingly these words in his mouth. And I myself will be in association with his mouth. But say, hey, man, it's your choice.
Yeah.
But I'm not letting you off the hook that easy here. I just want to put a stop on number two. You're my guy. I want you to do it. And even if I have Aaron be the spokesperson, so you have a little more confidence to get started here, then I'm going to tell him what I've told you. Isn't that Moshe's role for all of us? I want you to tell all of humanity what I have just told you. Isn't that how the Torah will
reveal? Absolutely. He was in the lab. He was taking dictation, and he was sharing it with us.
Yeah. The purpose of Moshe was Yahweh told him what he wanted the rest of us to know, so he starts right with Aaron. You might as well get used to it, pal. You're going to explain what I've just told you. It's the first time of a lifetime of doing that. It's how we're going to work together. So I will be the source of teaching and guidance. Yara. Yara is in the half a dozen most important verbs in the Torah because Yara is the basis of Torah. All Hebrew nouns have as their origin an actionable form, the verbal form. And the verbal form is the principal way of defining the noun. And so what is it that Yahweh is going to convey through Moshe?
Teaching.
Yeah, Torah teaching. So it says here, and I will be the source of the Yara. I will be the source of the teaching and guidance.
Yeah, his enlightenment.
Moshe is not the source of the Torah. He's the
You know, I've been dabbling in the Greek stuff, and it's like, it's always the Mosaic laws, and I'm going, first of all, no law is teaching, and secondly, it's not Moshe's. I mean, he's Yahweh is telling him, and he's telling you, and he's written it down so you won't get confused. So it's not being passed on verbally. There is no oral Torah.
Right. Yeah.
So
Moshe was definitely a convert. No, that's not to demean Moshe.
No.
Because being the conduit is the greatest honor you could possibly have. And it's an extremely important job because God does not like to show off, doesn't like to shout from the mountaintops. He likes to convey his message through people because he created people for the express purpose of doing that. But it's not Moshe's Torah. Yahweh's Torah. And so Yahweh is saying, I am the source of the teaching. I am the source of the guidance, the instruction, and the direction. For both of you, accordingly, regarding what relationally and beneficially you should choose to act upon and engage in. What good is guidance unless you act upon it?
Nothing at all. Cerebral. But you don't do anything.
Right. What's the instruction unless you engage based upon the way you were instructed? And I flew an airplane today. If I didn't act upon the instruction that I've had, I've never gotten it off the ground. Which might be good, but I never could have landed. And in any relationship, is there any benefit if one person is the couch potato and the other person is doing all the work?
No.
No, it's miserable for everybody, even for the person being served. So, if God's going to give instruction, the instruction only has merit if we act upon it. Guidance requires us to engage based upon what has been conveyed, or to have merit. And so, he is saying here that this is, by the way, not about faith. There's no action in faith.
No.
This is about acting. So I'm going to give you guidance that you can engage in, instruction that you can act upon. And if you notice a saw here, I would like you and others to do with them choosing on their own decision to actually act and genuinely engage in accordance with my will. This was scribed in the call stem, which is relational stem that conveys that this message should be interpreted literally. Imperfect conjugation, telling us that this work will be ongoing, continuing to unfold throughout time, and the jussive mood. The jussive mood is third person volition, so that's of those being spoken to, with a paragogic non-ending, which is an expression of first person volition. This is God's will that we should choose. Double volition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what other language has a mood that expresses volition? Choice, free will. I don't know that. And yet, 100% of the moods in Hebrew express choice, volition. Volition in the first, second, third person. In this particular case, you've got volition expressed in the first and third person. So it's God's choice, His desire, His will, that we choose of our own free will to act based upon the guidance and instruction He's offered.
And you couldn't interpret it any other way.
I've never seen
you should do what you should engage and you should make. I even found is what's uplifting and beneficial. It's an uplifting and beneficial act, but it's one that you choose to do. And all that's easily found. So, I mean, it's not confusing. It's not a confusing translation. It's exactly what it means.
And it follows my it's not only my single most important word because it's the word that led me to Yahweh. But since so many have come following the path that I blazed through the Torah and prophets, this is a word that probably has a profound meaning in the lives of many of our listeners and readers. Asher.
Sure.
Asher is that word that says that the source of teaching for both of you accordingly will be relationally and beneficially designed to reveal the path to live life in the most productive and prosperous way.
Well, let me show you how those two words actually say exactly what you're saying. If you look at Asher, first of all, which is pointing to the action, or what it's about to give you the action. If you had Asher, you've got an Aleph and a Shemek and a Rosh. So you've got Yah's nourishing words produce a observer. Well, this observer, when I look at a Rosh or Rosh, I'm always thinking about primarily engaging your brain. You're looking at something, you're reading things, you're starting to understand. And then, but the next word that it's pointing to, according to the grammar, is a Shah. And a Shah is a perspective, an eye, and a Shemek, and a with words, so a perspective that's through those words, and the last letter becomes a henna, a hey, which is a person who's not only engaged in observing, but also is walking, is taking, going down the path. So, I mean, any way you look at it, it answers your question. It verifies your question, your statement. So,
and look at for a moment just Yara. The basis of Torah.
Uh-huh.
The first is three letters in Yara.
Right.
A yod, a rosh, and a hey.
Right.
The yod is written as the literal hand of God, first letter of God's name. The upper arm reaching down, forearm reaching out with an open hand.
Okay.
The hand of a mother or a father towards their child. In our case, right. It's God's hand reaching out and down to us with an open hand. So the hand of God reaching out to Rosh, those who are observers, picture of a person's head, eyes, and ears, and brain. A person who is observant, who listens and processes that information. prioritizes that information, Rosh, and then the head. And as a result, stands up, looks up, and reaches up. That's how the hay is designed. It's the person standing up and reaching up to God, looking up to God. The basis of him. Pay attention. That's the verb that explains the meaning of Torah. And, you know, there isn't any Hebrew scholar in the world that would dispute the realization that Yara is the basis of Torah. In fact, the first time that Yahweh introduces Torah as something that he is explaining the meaning, he explains it by saying it's based on Yara. They all know it. And you can't get anything but source from which instruction, guidance, and direction flow from Yara. There is no other meaning.
No.
You can't get law.
No.
It isn't there. So, yeah. I say this is a source of teaching for both of you accordingly regarding what is relationally and beneficial to the relationship that demonstrates the narrow and straight path to walk to get the most out of life. Should you choose to act upon it and engage? That's the Moed Mikre. That's the Kara that he is inviting them to participate in. This isn't Moshe saying, speak to him, everything's going to be happy, he's happy, you're happy, you know, we're going to have this great fun that you know. I'm telling you, in these two sentences, exactly what's going to happen over the next 4 years. This is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen when we go into Egypt. This is how I'm going to liberate my children. This is how I'm going to offer the same solution for everyone who will ever live. And this is the result of it. If you pay attention to this teaching and guidance and act upon it. All laid out, if you just take the time to study it.
After a while, you gave so many different angles, and it all comes out the same way. And it's the most amazing thing to me, even today. I mean, I've never seen the thing put together the way this is put together. It doesn't matter which way you started or which way you wind up. If you dig deep enough, it's all exactly that, and you just can't twist it. I mean, you have to purposely twist it. I mean, you just cannot get there. You'd get to the same place. I just feel stupid that it took so long to figure, you know, I had to get so much help to get there. But at least I got there.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the gripes about religion, you know, Christians will say, well, that's sort of thing, that's for the Jews. You know, we have our New Testament. Well, that's not God's position. Listen to this.
No.
As proof that Yahweh wants us to walk along the same path that was traveled by Moshe and Aaron, and to be guided by the same Torah, source of guidance and instruction. No matter our ethnicity, regardless of where or when we live, this is what follows. And Yahweh said to Moshe and Aaron, the one who draws out and the one who brings enlightened free will regarding that alternative relationship. This specifically, though, is the engraved prescription, chukah, that which is clearly communicated and inscribed in writing, chiseled into stone. Of what?
That was the ten statements. So the Torah is written out.
Well, he said a Passover, a Pesach.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people might think that I'm out on a limb when I make these connections between Kara, for example, and the Mikra, and saying what's being brought forth before you is the seven invitations to meet God and be welcomed into his family. And that's what this is all about, is me introducing to you these seven invitations and the role they play in mitigating the differences between us, resolving your mortality, resolving your imperfections, resolving your estrangement, resolving your relative lack of power. that I have this plan that's going to resolve all of those things for your benefit. And that's what he was saying by Kara. And if for a moment you think, well, you know, he's prone to extrapolate. But how can I be prone to extrapolate when this next statement is, and Yahweh said to Moshe and Aaron, this specifically is the engraved prescription, the clearly communicated and inscribed meaning or portrayal, which cuts those into a share of the relationship of Esau, of Passover. I'm telling you, every bit of this is, I have a path that we're going to walk out of Egypt. It's the same exact path that I took Abraham and Yitzhak up Mount Moriah to serve as a dress rehearsal and a prophetic example of what I was going to do in that same place 2,000 years later. And now he's telling Moshe, this whole story of what's going to transpire out of Egypt is going to be based on these same seven events. And they're going to play out in the life of my people, no matter where they are, when they live. This is all about the engraved prescription of Esau to Passover. Every son of a mistaken stranger, you can't assume it. No numbers. A foreigner or alien who does not understand, who feigns or pretends to be in association to seek favor while recognizing false and foreign gods, a Nefer is not invited. They are excluded.
And thank goodness he did.
Oh.
And you don't understand. You've committed him to Sheol.
Right. Yeah, the worst thing that a person could possibly do, and this is God's warning, is to be invited to and capitalize on Passover and not take the next step, which is matzah.
Yeah.
Or capitalize on Passover and not understand what it means. Why? Because Passover only does one thing for you. It makes you immortal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're immortal and imperfect, if you're immortal and estranged because you don't take advantage of matzah and bakutim, firstborn children, and unyeasted bread, well, there's only one place for souls to go that are immortal and imperfect and estranged from God. Sheol, hell. So God said, no, I don't want you to participate in this if you're into your false gods, your lords, your Allahs, your Jesuses, your Buddhas. If you're into false gods, don't do this. It's counterproductive.
Well, you know, there's another... I was just going to say there's another thing you pick up in here too on Nekar and Akal, who is he's giving a warning for straddling the fence. Cannot be in both camps. All that's in there as well. Don't be associated with other false gods. It's like the statements in stone. You know, I have no other gods around me. You cannot drag any of that stuff with you. It's more than just being a foreigner and not understanding. Some people actually start to learn this, and then they want to drag all the Christianity or whatever with them, or the rabbinical Judaism or combinations of whatever. He's saying, you know, that he ain't going to take it. He's not going. You can't get there.
You've got to be right. You have to understand what he's offering and act upon it. You can't be mistaken.
You can't straddle the fence. You have to make a choice.
Proclaiming your loyalty and pledge of allegiance to another country or to house today. You know that one of the forms you have to fill out is the Patriot Act? And on the Patriot Act, you have to give all sorts of personal information, including your Social Security number, for the Patriot Act when you sell a house.
Now, is
every government wants to be in your pocket. So, if you're mistaken, if you're alienated, if you don't understand, if you're feigning and pretending to be in an association just to seek favor, don't consume it. Don't partake in it. Counterproductive. That destroys the Christianity myth that, God wants everyone to be saved. No, he doesn't. Eternal life is something that should be dreaded unless you're right about everything else, unless you answer all the other invitations, because it's an eternity separated from God.
Mm-hmm.
However, every individual coworker, associate, who belongs to and who longs to be acquired, who longs to be redeemed, wants to be part of the flock, when you have circumcised him, then at that time he may participate in it. So it doesn't matter your ethnicity. So don't get caught up on the fact that I'm talking about somebody from a different country, you know, America versus Israel or Babylon versus Egypt. So that's not what I'm talking about here. If you really want to be part of the family, genuinely want to be adopted, that this is what you long for, and you demonstrate it as a man by being circumcised, that's your signature. But I'm showing visually I am separated from these human schemes. Then you're welcome. But don't do it without being circumcised, because circumcision is the sign that you have come to understand and accept and acted upon the five terms and conditions of the covenant. It's the sign that you are rejecting human association and affiliation, and that you're going to raise your children to accept the Torah teaching and be part of the covenant, as opposed to human religious and political schemes. So those, they can participate in it. Doesn't matter your ethnicity. But the temporary resident, the one who is just passing through and does not intend to stay, and the hired worker, the paid servant or mercenary, no, don't consume it. So God is saying, this isn't for everybody. Well, you know, when we studied his the second statement, yes, and stone, what percentage of the world's population did he say were going to benefit from his the terms and conditions of his covenant?
A handful.
Did he say thousands? Thousands.
Thousands out of billions, though.
Yeah, thousands. Thousands. Thousands amongst billions is 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So he's making it really clear. This is going to be a small number of people relative to the number of population of the earth. Anything.
That would not have been his desire. That would not have been his desire, but that's the reality of the power of religion and politics and how lazy we are.
I don't know.
Sorry, where there's two brothers again. We either don't care because we're too lazy or too busy couch potatoes, or we're interested in everything else, or else we're so mesmerized by religion and politics and power of armies or whatever, that we're drawn to that, and that was Abraham's two brothers. That's what their names meant. So,
you know, Kirk, I'm not so sure that he does care. So that
well, I think he's a rationalist. I think he understands that they won't. So, I mean, I don't think he loses sleep over it. He's excited about who turns to him. But I think, you know, the more the merrier. But he obviously knows that the most he would get would be during Sukkot the last 1,000 years.
The children, a million children. I don't think it matters.
Yeah. I could be just as happy with four or five.
Four or five, yeah. I just don't think it matters to him. Because I think it would matter to him if religion was right. If religion is right and there's only heaven or hell, so that everyone, you know, the very few come to know him, and everybody else ends having their souls tortured forever, which would make God a real sicko. If that were the case, and God was this warped, sadistic being, or a jerk, a real jerk, then that would be a problem. But since the overwhelming preponderance of human souls simply cease to exist, there's no reason for God to care about others. Those that choose to be part of his family, wonderful. Those that choose not to, no big deal. They got to live their life. They got free will. It's just when it's over, it's over. No punishment, no reward, it's just their soul simply ceases to exist. And if you add to that, yes, some percentage, some tiny fraction of 1%, will go to Sheol, eternal separation. No torture in Sheol, it's just a lifeless prison like a black hole where souls that are immortal, because they're associated with Hasatan, the adversary, and led people astray, that they're incarcerated there with like-minded souls. That'll be torment enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually appropriate because they actively engaged in leading people away from God. They were frauds on the single worst thing they could possibly be fraudulent about. That puts every hope in shield. Every televangelist in shield. Probably every king and president in shield. Making false promises to lead people astray. So, that's just. These are people who prayed on other souls. So that's appropriate. And the fact that most souls simply cease to exist puts God in a position where the 1 in a million that chooses them, that's more than enough. So I don't think he has any problem with a percentage. So in one home, they left. Not one civic center. Not in one synagogue. Not in one mosque. Not in one church. In one home, because the house and the family models the purpose of the covenant, it shall be consumed. A call. You should not take out of the home and family any portion of the flesh outside. And the bones you should not break or destroy of his. Specific instructions. They aren't to be tossed away, but instead thought about. So, there's only one single solitary home from God's perspective. That's why Bat Ishad, one exclusively, home, family, household, one covenant.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it should be consumed, a call. Do not take it out of the home, of the family. Pesach does not exist outside of the covenant family of God. Pesach is only the doorway to God's home, the doorway to eternal life. Don't ever consider anything regarding Pesach apart from God's family. It is the doorway to his home, to the family of God, to the covenant, to the Berurah. And outside of that understanding, as the doorway into the covenant family, Pesach is counterproductive. And as the doorway to God's home and to eternal life, it is enormously beneficial. So just don't take it outside. This isn't part of the profane. Pesach isn't bent to, or none of the invitations are to be part of humanity. But to be separated from humanity and being a part of God's family. It's not about being tossed out, but being brought in. Then he says, and the bones you should not break or destroy. The reason for that.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect Passover family, not had his bones broken, would he?
No.
That is a prophecy.
Yeah.
And this is not about being brutal. There are animals that were clearly made to be food. I mean, what defenses does a bunny rabbit have? I mean, rabbits were made to be food.
Yeah.
That sounds sad, but that's why they breed so enormously fast, you know? Now, that makes sense, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, all you have to do is go to parts of Australia where they brought, you know, they didn't have any predators, and the British Navy would bring rabbits to populate islands so they'd have food in case they ever got shipwrecked or came back. And they would breed so fast, when they brought them to Australia, they couldn't, there was no real predators to eat them up. So they became so great that you're either raising cows or you're raising rabbits, because they will eat everything. They put up fences. They've done all kinds of things to exterminate them. They're not your friend when it gets to be if they're not eaten up, held in check by
a
predator.
Food. And food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what purpose does a cow serve other than food? It's not an animal that's going to proliferate out there in the wild and protect itself. It's food. And so, the lamb is food. Eat it, but don't maul it.
Yeah.
Don't beat the crap out of it.
Yeah.
No, the Passover lamb is to be nourished. Eat it inside the home. This is not for everybody. Don't take it outside. Don't be offering people outside of the family this. Only those that want to be part of the family should partake it. The entire community of Yisrael will choose to act accordingly regarding this. God is saying, listen, Moshe, I'm not going to promise you that Yisrael is going to do the right thing most of the time or even a lot of the time. But I'm going to tell you this one time they are. There's not going to be a single exception. When it comes to the doorway to life of Passover, the first time it's celebrated in Egypt, I'm here to tell you that everybody's going to go along. You're going to have 100% of the people acting in this way. The entire community, Edom of witnesses, is assembled to provide testimony, to memorialize the agreement in a way that would be remembered. Of Yisrael, of individuals who engage in the door with God, will choose to act accordingly regarding this. Shemot names, Exodus 12:47. Indeed, if and when a person from a different ethnicity, a GER, an individual from a different geographical location, in association with you, a Kama, has a guest, a GER, as an individual who is gathering, congregating, and dwelling together with you, demonstrating the proper reverence and respect. Pesach, now when they engage in and act upon Pesach, to approach Yahweh, to draw near, his every remembrance must be circumcised, bringing prior associations to an end.
Separate.
So if you had any questions why circumcision plays a role and what it represents, it was answered right there.
Mm-hmm.
So if and when an individual like you and me, we're, you know, I'm Sioux Indian and Irish, I'm not ethnicity from an ethnic point of view, Israel. A person like us, from a different ethnicity, in association with Israel, those who engage in the door with God, as a guest, as an individual who congregates and dwells together, engages in Pesach to approach Yahweh, to draw near, his every zakar, his every proclamation, his every remembrance must be circumcised. So what is being separated? We're being separated from our remembrance and our affinity for religion and politics.
Right.
You want to draw near, then disassociate every memory and public proclamation, bringing to an end those prior associations. But it's explained very literally for us, very beneficially for us, clearly for us. At that point, what argument would you have to say if that circumcision represents anything other than us expressing that we are disassociating our prior declarations and remembrances and affinities with to an institution, particularly religion and politics?
Right. You couldn't get this. It's a very dramatic way to make the point. I mean, and it's he's making it very clear. Kodesh, you're separated. I mean, how many times is there a chet and a separation and a protective fence or a fence that separates this from that? I mean, the themes run page after page after page of where I'm separating to protect and I'm separating to keep you out. And all that is symbolic. And this is symbolic as well. Of course, it has its benefits as well. And unfortunately, we don't have JB here to talk about it for half an hour on all the benefits of it and the things about it. But still, I think it's the most poignant thing. What a deal. I mean, what a explanation point on the story.
Yes. Yeah, he's clearly conveyed the purpose of it. You must be cut off and removed, taking action with an oath to cease and desist your remembrance, your public proclamations, turning around and going in the opposite direction. Why do that? Every public event I go to, if they're going to play the national anthem, I do exactly this time. I turn around and I go in the opposite direction. Written in the Nipple imperative. With the Nipple stem, the subject carries out and receives the benefit of the verb's actions. So you not only distance yourself from these prior proclamations and oaths, but you receive the benefit of having done so. That's what the Nipple stem says. What a marvelous way of conveying that. And the imperative, which means that it's the mood that expresses first person volition, an intention or exhortation.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that time, he may approach and draw near, para, and participate in it, and he shall exist similar to the native-born person. So, if you have done what Abraham did, and you're halfway to Israel out of Babylon in Haran, if you're like Noah that was separated from the community and out there living by himself or his family, if you have separated yourself from religion and politics, which is the first part, then he's saying, you can draw near. You can participate in it. And if you do it as somebody who's walked away from religion and politics, then you're going to be just like the native-born person.
Mm-hmm.
But the totality of the uncircumcised, they shall not partake in it. Over and over again. If you're not circumcised, don't participate in Passover. If you're not circumcised, that's the fifth condition of the covenant. If you don't accept the terms and conditions of the covenant,
nothing will you value nothing. Could you make it clearer? I mean, could you teach it any?
No, I think it's easy.
That's marvelous at the simplicity of it. I mean, it's even I look at all my little notes on words. I'm not going to bore you with all of them, but they all pretty much make it even clearer and clearer and clearer. It's just wow.
Well, how do you get any profound or important than this? One, each single, solitary, and explicit Torah, source of teaching, guiding, instruction, and direction, shall actually and always exist on behalf of the native-born person, Ha-Ezra,
mm-hmm.
and for the individual from a different ethnicity, Ger, who as a guest considers the implications while gathering together and dwelling within your midst. So, how do you get a New Testament out of that? Something for the Jews, something for the Gentiles. No, you can't get a New Testament out of that. One Torah exists for everybody. One source of teaching, one source of guidance for everyone. So long as you want to dwell as part of this community, there's only one set of guidance.
How could someone study this their whole life and not know that that's what that means?
Well, that was black and white. I don't even know how you mistranslate.
I mean, if you don't read the Torah, but how could you be someone who claims to read the Torah their whole life and they can't look up those words?
How do you justify calling Christianity, which says, you know, that, the Torah is for the Jews and this new gospel is
for
the
Gentiles? Yeah.
And God is saying it's just the opposite. No, there's one Torah teaching is for everybody. Only one source of direction, only one source of guidance. It's for everybody. For all of those who want to be part of this community. So, Kirk, my friend, I know you've done some studying. We'll focus on that next week. Where you took some things out of the Psalms, the Mizmor, and also the Sermon on the Mount on Matanyah. You took your first encounter of translating.
My first serious approach to translating the Greek into the English and then from the English back into the Hebrew. And I think I did have one question about that. There's a fellow translator, and I know you do pretty good on this stuff, but when I go back and try to find, I noticed that I did get better at this as I progressed. I started going through an awful lot of material to figure out which word in the Greek is used that would be most appropriate in the Hebrew. And most of the time, I think I'm knowledgeable enough that the ones that I chose, that has to be that for a multitude of reasons. I've probably looked up four or five, but some of these words can be, it might be five choices or more for the Hebrew words. Is there such a thing as a Greek-Hebrew lexicon? I haven't found anything, so I didn't know. Maybe some book somewhere if somebody did it. But if so, I was just wondering why no one ever did. We know
right.
that he's speaking Hebrew. I mean, all these Christian scholars, we know he was speaking Hebrew. And we know they
right.
got it in Greek because that was the only option, the only thing that was left of those notations, of those witness writings. And,
yeah.
you know, I think I got pretty good at it, but it does, boy, you have to jump through hoops for a long time to figure out which word is most appropriate.
Well, the only way that I can understand what Yosha was saying is I would have to look at what he was citing from in the Torah, Prophets, mm-hmm. and Psalms, and then view his words from the perspective of the words he actually used. And,
yeah.
you know, some of the most profound things, you know, upon this rock I will build my mikra.
Mikra.
When you study the Greek, it leads you directly to the Hebrew words that he actually spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to understand it, you've got to think about it and understand it from the perspective of Hebrew. That's all true.
Yeah, that's pretty much my attempt. But
it was
rewarding, though. I mean, I will say, because Matthew, especially Matthew 5, is really rewarding. And then if you go to Dabarim, that's really cool. There's some matchups on there. So I look forward to doing sharing with you whatever.
That'll be our next week's program. If you could send me some of the things that you specifically want to cover, I'll be your host and interview you. Okay, so if you just give me an email.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right, I will do that.
All right. Happy Shabbat.
All right.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next week.
Enjoy. Shabbat Shalom. Have fun tomorrow. Take care.